Welcome to our Spear podcast, Let's Ask an Expert, the Gender Dimension in Natural Science Research. My name is Christine Steffens from RWTH Aachen University, and I am part of the Spear Consortium, an inspiring group of professionals working fervently to make research institutions more equal. Spear is a project funded under the Horizon 2020 Framework Program, with a mandate to initiate institutional change in 9 European research performing organizations by implementing gender equality plans as a key instrument to improving gender equality. What we advocate is a more gender balanced educational environment, a stronger dimension of gender in the research content, hand in hand with a reduction of structural barriers. With me today is Thomas Brage. Thomas Brage is professor of physics at the Division of Mathematical Physics of the Department of Physics at Lund University in Sweden. For the last 15 years, he has been intensively involved in gender equality work in natural science, especially in physics and math-intensive disciplines. He gives talks on gender and physics around Europe and is active in several European networks. For instance, in the League of European Research Universities Network, LERU for short, where he acts as steering group member of the Policy Group for Equality, Diversity and Inclusion. Further, he is part of the GENERA Network for Gender and Physics, which recently held a conference on the gender dimension in physics and math-intensive research and teaching. He is also a member of university advisory boards and expert panels for equality, diversity and inclusion at the National University of Ireland in Galway, and the Southern University of Denmark. At Lund University, he has led several equality projects, including the Gender Certification Project, the Anti-Discrimination Education, and the Core Values Project. Welcome, Professor Brage. It is a pleasure and honor to have you here with us today to talk about the gender dimension in natural science research, especially in physics and math-intensive disciplines. Increasing gender equality in research and innovation is a political priority of the European Commission. Despite long-standing and focused effort, dedicated funds and well-established regulatory framework, structural barriers to gender equality in research and innovation still persist. Especially in STEM, there's often the argument of objectivity and freedom of research when talking about implementing the gender dimension in research. Thomas, it's likewise in your field of expertise in physics and maths. So to start with, can you explain to us, does gender play a role in physics and math intensive research?
Well, thank you for having me here. And for sure, I mean, what we have to remember is to think about what are we talking about when we say, for example, physics in this context. And we're interested in the sociology of physics, right? How people interact and how we create knowledge and so on and so forth. And therefore, we can't any longer say that physics is only stars or physics is only electrons or particles and they don't have a sex and gender, because physics is a human endeavor. Physics is what physicists do. And since if you have that definition, of course gender and diversity issues are very important, as in all other things humans do and in all other ways humans interact. So we can see that, we can see it in the numbers, we can see how we are on the worst end when it comes to segregation between the sexes, that you, women and men, for example, are picking different careers or have different speed in the career and so on. We can see it in the culture. We have probably more of harassment and so on because we have a culture that is very much focused on elitism, that we are specially selected. Someone say that the priesthood of physics almost, which is very exclusive to some groups, excluding to some group. So for sure, both the culture and the numbers, and we can then start now to also understand how the research production, of course, is formed by who and how we are doing things. So yes, and we might even be worse off.
Yeah, so you just went a little bit into it. So what are the challenges there in, including gender as a dimension in physics and math research then?
Well, one of the main challenges are the physicists, for example, or the mathematicians. But I use now physicists throughout this, so you know that it's a wider definition. We are so convinced that we are dealing with an objective science. We are studying something. And of course, that has been very successful within the research field to have the positivism and so on. In one way, we have, if you measure success in the outcome and, of technical solutions or understanding or describing at least the world around us and predicting experiments and so on. But that is also kind of leaking or feeding in, bleeding into everything we do. And therefore, you will find a stronger resistance with physicists and with other scientists, I would say, to even question that physics could be formed by sociology and so on. And you can see many examples of that. So I think that's a special challenge that we have when we approach physics.
Mm-hmm. Would you then say that these challenges differ across the other natural science disciplines then?
I think it is... sickness. It's something that affects all scientists because we, of course, are strong believers of positivism. We are strong believers in this objectivity. But I think if you're doing some science that bleeds into society or some science that talk life science, for example, you are more humble. Physicists have, and mathematicians maybe, have been put on a pinnacle. And we have been the crown jewel of science and that kind of expressions. And I think we are used to be able to think about ourselves as the one who can explain everything else. And you can see that when sociologists go in and study physicists, they tell the story about physicists trying to tell them and explain their science, to explain anthropology or something like that to someone who is an expert. Because they have a belief that physics transcends everything, physics is above everything, and thereby can explain everything. So everything else becomes small. Physicists think about themselves as the universal researchers like Leonardo da Vinci, but we are really very narrow, and we have very often very little understanding of the knowledge production in sociology and so on. So I think physicists are on the outer scale together with mathematicians, possibly. And you will see, in general, different and less resistance maybe in biology, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a different resistance that maybe we can come to that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and I also imagine that admitting that your research is biased is it can be pretty hurtful. To gather that insight.
Yes. And of course, you have to remember too, when you talk to powerful people in a field, they think about often their career is based on the values and the ideas and the concept, how they think about it. So they think about themselves as successful because of the system. And then if you go in and say, no, the system is biased, it could be perceived as a threat. So that's a barrier we have to go through.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Speaking of barriers, so in order to address the persisting barriers to gender equality in research and innovation, the Horizon Europe Framework Program now requires the integration of the gender dimension in research by default. So let's shed a little more light on the gender dimension in physics and math intensive research. Can you, for example, give us a research project where the gender dimension has been successfully implemented, or another good practice example?
I should explain that my research is doing atomic calculations on stellar atmospheres and so on. And I do think, of course, there is a in how that field is produced, how that field is explained and described is very much gendered, of course. But maybe my field is not the best example to start with, if you can understand. Mm-hmm. So, well, there are a number of examples, of course. If you go to the gendered innovation page or project, you will find examples that are applied physics. So that's, of course, the very much easiest. And I can, so my role in Lund has often been that I go in and work with other people and or maybe work on gender equality or gender project that are more broader than my own research. That this is not, I'm not trying to escape the problem, but I just try to explain what it is. So in applied research, for example, recently, when it comes to diversity, the medical physics department realized, or in the very worst way possible, that they have a biased way of doing the radiation. And that is when you are doing radiation on a patient, for example, you mark them with ink so you can focus. I will probably use the wrong word, but basically, so you can direct your radiation in a very efficient way. Mm-hmm. The ink they used was not possible to use on people with darker skin. The automatic, so to speak, focusing or whatever you call it, did not recognize the ink. So the person who had the darker skin had to spend a lot longer time on the table where this treatment should be done, which is very uncomfortable. And of course, linked to a lot of fear and maybe even angst to be under radiation. And that's an example that I never thought about. So this blind spot of people come in different shapes are, of course, very important to applied physicists. But I must say, going to medical physics departments in general, it's a non-issue very often, just like it is. The physicists think that we are doing, even there, they think they're doing something that transcends everything and they don't have to think about those things. So that's one example. The other example where it's bleeded in is, of course, in education. So you can't talk about research without talking about education. They are integrated. And there is a lot of research and a lot of studies done on, for example, the bias in both how and what we teach. It's, and I had done myself, looked through some textbook and actually found sexist material, very limited material, and representation there is an enormous problem in physics. And when you can see also that physics textbooks are reproduced, they all look the same. And they all are built the same way. They all are using similar examples. And this, especially the examples and the representation of physics is very narrow. So there's really this discussion around that. And that's an interesting. The third one that I can mention is where it's more an observation than actually a study is it's a group here in Lund that became very aware and worried about the fact that they only had men in the research community and among the students, and that was combustion physics. And they did actually invite Londa Schiebinger, who is the head of Gender Innovation Project, and she did workshops with them, and they started to think about why is this? Are they only victim? So they realized that they could start to think about how they represent the science, what kind of examples they do. And also in the end, they extended their science in the sense that they started to not only in the lectures talk about machines and motor engines and so on, they also started to talk about what was actually the reason, very much the reason for the research, environmental impact and so on. And that changed the whole composition of the group. Now, I don't want to be essentialist here and say that women like environment and men like engines. I'm just saying that if you start to question and discuss how you present your science and what you apply it to and what questions you think are important, you become more inviting for a larger population and also different men and women and so on, and you become more relevant. So that's an interesting example. When it comes to the basic science, I think it's not in the we for a long time will not be able maybe to bring up cases, individual cases. It's more a general thing. It's more fundamental. We have to go in and think about our knowledge production at large. We have to go in and think about where is the bias or the gender aspect. And it's more general than thinking about one case. So we have to question about what happened to physics when it was only produced by a little portion of the population. How is the epistemology formed? And that's much, much harder, but very exciting questions. But it's much easier to talk about the representation and applications in the beginning. And I think that's where we have to start.
Yeah, thank you.
A long answer to short answer.
No. It's perfect because I just have a question concerning, you mentioned that another aspect is the composition of research teams. And you mentioned the research group at Lund University that asked themselves, okay, why are we not attracting other people, female people to work with us? Mm. So from your experience, what would you say, what can you do better? What challenges and opportunities are there to setting up gender equal research teams in general? What should be kept in mind?
Yeah, if you think about me as an individual professor in physics, so to speak, I think I can show that practicing selection where you choose to support shuttered students that might not naturally get supported. That is a very simple way of doing it, but you might be questioned and so on. But for example, I spent a lot of time in Shanghai working in Fudan. I came there was many, many master students and some PhD students that were looking for projects. And by just selecting, working with a few, but very brilliant women there, equally good, but not recognized in the same way as the men, you can make a difference. And I mean, I did consciously do that. There is, unfortunately, very little other diversity than gender in the Chinese universities. But that was an important learning experience, how easy it could be by just... Because in the selection procedure of a master students that you want to work with or a PhD student and so on, a very important aspect there is encouragement. We know that the majority, the students that are the majority of PhD or master students, they come naturally into that. But if you like to become more diverse, you have to encourage the minorities. And of course, they don't naturally see them there. Self there. So very often it's just to, I have several cases where you just talk to, for example, a master student and say, you should apply. You are really good at this, you should apply. And that is a small little everyday experience which I bring with me, and it made a very big difference. So I would say that 60-70% of the students I worked with in China were women. And that was a simple process. We just consciously said, okay, we support this group, which we don't see among the staff and so on. Also interesting, it's my best research. The research became also much better. We know that, or it's much more interesting to work with people with different backgrounds, so to speak. So that one, and now I'm drifted away here, so I try to catch up myself. How to work with the diverse. Yeah, and then that's recruitment, and recruitment is very important. And I think when you work with recruitment, we have to make a paradigm shift. We always work with recruitment going out, you know, telling people, oh, we are fantastic, you should come. And we very rarely listen. I like to think about transformative processes, and I think we should always bring that with us in whatever we do. What do I mean by that? Well, when I work with leadership program, I work with a transformative leadership program, which means I'm not only teaching leaders, so to speak, how do you do this and that. I'm teaching them what's wrong with the system and how can we change it. When we work now with tenure track assistant professors, we're not only teaching them this is how you make a career in the university, we're also telling them what's flawed in the career. The career is not a fixed system. The university is not, well, it's kind of cut in stone, but it's not only that. It can be changed. And this is people who know how to transform the system. And I think you should work like that when you do recruitment too. You should not only go out and preach, you should go out and listen to the minorities and see why don't they choose physics? What are their concerns and worries about the future? And then you go take that back and try to say, oh, what can we do to address this problem? Instead of only saying, oh, we should convince the poor women and the poor minorities to understand how fantastic we are. So that's the recruitment. Then the next step would be the retainment. And maybe we come to that later. All the things you can do to retain people who doesn't feel naturally belonging to the system. So I rest there.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just thinking, especially for project leaders, would you say that it's important for them to learn how to transform their recruitment processes for their project teams, and basically to teach them how to have a really good recruitment process to attract talent and people with all different kinds of backgrounds.
You know, we are thinking about ourselves when we come to recruiter, and I think there is a place for that. I'm not saying this is wrong, but we think about ourselves, physicists not the least, as entertainers. We are going to go in and wow people with all the fantastic pictures and so on, and that's of course fantastic. But it stops there. It's a one-way communication. And very rarely I see people actually sit down and talk to the people they're trying to recruit. So, yes, I think we need to learn that. And it's very close to what we should learn anyway. And that's good pedagogic, so to speak, that when you have discussion and peer learning and all that, which enhances the feeling of belonging. And as a teacher, you can also learn from that. I'm not one. Now, some people might hear me and say, oh, he doesn't believe in knowledge transfer. I didn't mean that. We have a fantastic science to talk about. But if we are serious about wanting to have a more diverse population of physicists, we need to listen. We're doing something wrong. We are not. We can stand there and what we think is fantastic. Like the... Look at the combustion physicist, thought it was so funny to talk about, or interesting to talk about the engines inside a Volvo and how it worked. And yes, it is, but not everybody thinks so. And they could then easily talk about other processes which has to do with combustion and the result of combustion, and thereby become more interesting. So that's a transformative system. So that is the mindset after my years in this, I think is... a key for me. Always think, how can this project I'm doing be transformative? So I'm not only changing what I want to change, I change myself or the system at the same time. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it completely does. I just want to get back to, you mentioned earlier, the retainment is also a broad field that needs to be addressed. And maybe you would like to say something about the retainment strategy.
Yeah, this is so hard to talk about because it's such a horrible thing. At the same time, it would be so easy to start to implement ways to work with it. We have, very much now we realize the bias in the system. And we can talk about measuring bias here and there and so on and so on forth. But I think everybody accepts that we as human beings have to be a bias, and that if it's used in the wrong way, we see this very bad effect of it. To question that is like non-scientific, I would say. But of course, Yeah. So we have to combat the bias. Not we cannot take away bias, but we can become aware of it and we can have help so that our decisions are not affected so much by it. So that's one part. And we in Lund are working very much on having bias observers, because bias awareness training is great. But it's a little bit like the fear of mouth mask and face masks. Sweden decided not to use face masks. Why do they want to use face masks? Because when people have face masks, according to the argument here, I don't say it's correct, but I use it as a metaphor. We think we can be as close, we can hug each other and we can breathe close and we can, and so. So that is the concern, you know, if you become, you think you become aware of bias and then you go into meeting and said, I'm treated, I'm vaccinated. Mm-hmm. And actually there could be the opposite effect. So observers there helping us, critical friends, process observers, looking at bias, looking at systemic bias, looking at all these things that comes in, sexism, racism, homophobic, things that creeps in and people don't see, the everyday microaggressions and so on. Those, I think, will be essential. Then we, as the rest of society, but I think as universities, we might be worse because we have an old traditional system, and we also have a duty to go ahead and work against harassment. Sexual harassment has to stop. It will never stop completely. I'm not an idealist, but we have to. Recent studies where 25% of women have been sexually harassed, where, and this is such an awful number, 2-3% of our students seems to have been women student has been subjected to attempts of rape. I mean, there's so much knowledge about how we can work on this with our students, with our faculties, talking about boundaries, talking about consent and all that. That knowledge is there, but we don't do it. We have year after year after year seen 25% of women being subjected to harassment due to their gender, and we do nothing. And then we do another. Well, I'm exaggerating, but it feels like we don't do anything fundamentally. If this was another problem, if 25% of our students were burned by fire I'm sorry for being very extreme, but any other threat to the work environment and to the health of people would be treated with severity. But this is kind of, okay, oh dear, we have this problem. And very few times you see measures, strong measures going back. So there we have a challenge. And so long as we have that, we can only start to see how that is for other minoritized group. We see traces of it, and I'm not an expert on this, but we see traces on suicide statistics among LGBTQ plus population. And we see that there is suffering all the time, and we have so few ways of dealing with it. So I think that those two things could be focused, and it's also focused in Horizon 2020, and I hope the university has started to do it. Bias and harassment are two challenges we should really, and that's about the culture then. So.
Yeah, and I hope the cultural change will continue and will be fruitful in the future, hopefully. So we see the numbers decreasing. I want to get back to.
And then, of course, I'm sorry. We of course, also then what we have talked about before, we have to look at and question and transform our knowledge production too. So it becomes, so more people feel they belong and that it's relevant and all that. But yeah.
Yeah, coming back to what universities at the organizational level maybe need to pay attention to in order to foster equal academic work and study environments. Do you have an example maybe from your university?
Yeah, we have been working for a long time, and I think we have to the Horizon 2020 requirements, what not on gaps, but what should be in the gaps, are excellent and beautiful. And I think there are some missing things, but I have some example I think is very fruitful. We are kind of proud of that. We very early started to talk about gender certification, and that's must be 20 years ago now. And that was before we knew about what the Athena Swan and the Casper project is now and all that. And it was really interesting to put what happens when you put together certification and gender. We had seen it. People can apply, groups, departments, courses could apply for environmental certification. And that was something that we had done. And there was not very few people questioned that. But when we came with the gender certification, it became first very, very stormy sea. And actually, the woman I worked with had to stop doing it. But for a while, but anyway, what happened in the department is that they really want to be certified. So it was a good motor for engine for the processes. But what we had the problem being too isolated and too small. And now we know all what happens now when this is actually. But I was happy to explore that. And I think it helped Lund to take a first step into understanding that this is deeper than just counting numbers or writing policies. The second one that I think is a good example is what we always have to do is to work with the leadership. And we had the ACCA leadership program. I was in the beginning not a teacher. I was just in some sort of advisory group to it. But more and more, I got involved in actually leading the program, together, co-leading the program. And having these transformative leadership programs, which we have all too few of. I only know about ACCA, and actually our friends in Zurich has been looking for programs. They could only find ACCA, but now there is a transformative leadership program also in Switzerland called HIT, and they have kind of not copied, but they are inspired by ACCA and also have this transformative. I guess I don't have to dwell on that, but that is basically always having a gender perspective, whatever you teach. So that's two. And the third one was the core value projects, when I think it's very, very important to, when you get tired of defending the word gender, you can go to core values, because that's what it's all about. And we got from our administration good support to actually deeply go into the question, why are core values so popular to talk about? What can we use them for? And why is there a friction between some core values, the academic freedom and so on, and what is perceived as gender equality? Why do people put these against each other? So, and that was very interesting. And I worked with excellent people in sociology of law, in ethnology and so on. And I like that book and I use it very often as, and of course the conclusion is that the different academic values, or the different values, the academic values and the, should we call them legal values, are interdependent. You can't have academic freedom if you don't have equality, because you want academic freedom for everybody. You can't have meritocracy if you don't know how to measure merits in a way, and that then you have to go to equality and diversity work to understand the bias in our merit systems. And power, meritocracy, the power is not equally divided in the university. Men is 80% of the professors, for example. So to be able to get to the academic values, we have to have gender equality and diversity. And that was kind of the conclusion, of course. There's so much more in that book, but I hope. But that was the one. And nowadays we work with these unconscious bias observers, and also a transformative program for all our tenure track assistant professors in science faculty on one of these learning for change, we call it. And it used to be a mentoring for change. And it's always formed as a mentoring program, these transformative, bifocal, they sometimes call, where you try to teach them how to make a career, but you also teach them what's wrong. But we have now transformed it into a course. And the positive thing about that is that you can formulate, a course has a course plan and it has expected learning goals. And it also gives you merits in the form of credits and so on, in some way. So that was the invention we had now this year, and I haven't seen it done anywhere else, so I'm really looking forward, and it is a big change. For example, if I may give it as an example.
Sure. Yeah.
The mentors, the people who are actually they are kind of supervisors, they're much more than a supervisor, but anyway, the mentors, if we wanted to professionalize the mentorship. And we know that from the studies of Fries and so on that has studied this, that is very important. And how do you professionalize something? Well, you give them credit. You give them not time or money. Money is time, so to speak. You give them, you put it into the description of the position, or you give the research group money for it, so to speak. And the resistance to this was enormous. I mean, people said, no, you can't pay mentors. That's something professors should do anyway. Well, we all know it's always the same professors that can be mentors. Some professors you would not choose as mentors, sorry, to be blunt. And so why should this not be rewarded? But when we transformed it into a course and we said that these mentors are co-teachers and they don't, it's not a one-to-one mentor-menteeship. It's actually a group of mentees for each mentors. We can reward them with money or time. So that is a secondary effect of this. So they become professionalized, the mentors, and of course they become professional, like teachers. And we also then formalize what we really want to get out. What change should there be inside the mentees by formulating expected learning goals. So that's a recent project together with the unconscious bias observers that I'm happy to talk about.
Yes, perfect. And I think we will also provide more information on the core values project in the description of the podcast.
We have a book on that. So that, yeah. Great. And in that booklet, there is a second part which talks about core value projects, and you will find description of the leadership and the gender certification project in there, for example.
Great. And I also have a slight correction to make, because earlier you mentioned the Horizon Framework Program. Horizon 2020 is what you said, but I think you meant Horizon Europe, the new one.
Yeah, sure. I'm still in a Horizon 2020 project, so I always make that mistake.
Yeah,
sorry, thank you. Yes,
no problem. Horizon Europe. Just for our listeners, it was about the Horizon Europe program. Finally, we arrive at the last question of the interview, and it's a big one. So feel free to give out all your tips and tricks. In your opinion, what's the way forward to rendering natural science research more equal?
Well, that's what we were talking about.
Yes.
We're talking about, you know, we talk about this as projects, and now we did that project, you know. But it's, you can now, I think we have enough knowledge, we can start to really see how to build a successful gender equality and diversity organization within the university. And that is, of course, extremely important. And I've seen that now built in many universities. You have an action group, experts, but they are not experts, they are active. And they are the ones who kind of lead this, and they are working together with the dean, then, if you're talking about natural science, because they become experts on how to transform natural sciences. you have to educate your leaders, you have to make this relevant, and then you have all these different projects that, or these different tools to do that. We need to transform teaching and learning in the sense that teachers cannot any longer be unaware of these issues, like all other social issues and pedagogical issues. We all too often people get away by doing, bad teaching, which is a terrible waste of resources. But so that's one thing. We need to get into looking at how we do our research. We need to have combat bias in all our career paths and promotional paths. And we need to work against sexual harassment. So all these very important legs, but also building a sustainable framework for it. And that is to permanent have an action group, to have permanent way of having responsibility defined among leaders. With, for example, if it's now on the faculty level, it would be an assistant dean who has responsibility for these issues and answers directly to the dean, and so on. And have a group that spread this out into the workforce. So all that is one part. The other part, which I always say is to universities, find the agents of change, like we talked about here, and support them. There are pockets. I know when I was in some of the universities we've been talking about here today, that I found beautiful research done in a pocket somewhere inside the department, inside the faculty. And I just had to say, please support these and link them to other pockets and islands and make them instead a peninsula of change in having those individual islands working on different places. So there are people out there that are to have the knowledge, that have the energy, they need the time, they need to be promoted, and they need to get credit for what they're doing, and they need support and network. So this is simple. Most universities probably know who these are and where they are. And then it's a very simple way to kind of connect them, creating venues where they can meet and help each other and exchange and give them power to do the change, so to speak. And that is, of course, done through this action group that kind of support all these different initiative and link them together. So, one can also say on a bigger scale, universities have to get into not only the 21st, they have to get into the 20th century. They have to get the power, the opportunity, the structure to become good employers. We have a system now that does not promote that. We have universities that blames science foundations, the research foundations that give money, that's their fault. And the research foundations say, no, it's the university's fault. And it's all about not being able to take the responsibility as employers. And that's a constant backlash or hinder to what we're doing. So I look forward, and we have actually in one of the networks I'm in, the LERU, League of European Research Universities, we have a policy group for equality, diversity, and inclusion. And a couple of years ago, there was a paper produced on this, the inclusive university. So how a university needs to change to stay relevant. The university can't any longer just promote certain groups and not having a diverse population among students, and even more importantly, among professors. So we have lots of things to do, but it's been done in other sectors. So I think, and we as universities should be spearheading this, of course. And they should be listened to beautiful and wonderful projects like Spear. And I think there's so much knowledge now coming up within all these great projects, and I look forward to, and maybe you do that in Spear, to just put them all together and come up with these push on the university. Don't tell us you don't know what to do. Here, do this and be serious about it.
Yeah, you put it together beautifully, I think. And that's exactly what we're also doing in the Spear project. Especially as you mentioned, bringing together or identifying first the change agents. We also had a workshop on identifying those, because sometimes they're not that obvious at first sight. Like you mentioned, there might be pockets here and there at the faculties who are doing great work, but they are not promoted, or they are not really brought forward to be seen. So yeah, that's a really good tip for everyone, I think.
I like the requirement in the, for example, in the Irish, from the Irish Higher Education Foundation, authority, that if you want, they have a certain, within the Athena Swan requirement project and so on, they have requirement. And one of them is that if you promote the leader, they have to have experience with gender equality and so on, gender equality work. So I think there are hope that out there that we can change this. And I'm very, very impressed about what you're doing in the Spear project. And how, when I looked at South Danish University and so on, how successful they are in creating this, and how the people are listening to them. And I'm looking forward to that. I mean, in the history, I've seen so many cases that, you know, it's a death sentence to your career if you talk gender equality. And it might not come immediately. Sometimes it does, but it slowly comes, that you get kind of, destroyed in your career, if you want it like that. But I can see a future where this become essential and a requirement for a career, not something that is a burden to your career.
Yeah, there's hope for this.
Yeah, but we should be patient, but not too patient.
Yes, exactly. So, Thomas, thank you very much for your time and your interesting insights into the gender dimension and natural science research. It's been a pleasure having you here. And that was it.
We hope you enjoyed our podcast and conversation with Thomas Brage. If we have inspired you at least a bit, we can say that we are one inch closer to achieving our aims. You can find additional information on the subject on our project website under www.gender-spear.eu. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thank you for listening.